This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents The Final Days of Magic by J.D. Horn. Performed by Sophie Amos. December 19. 1. Lisette Perrault remembered a time when she wasn't filled with rage. Golden in hindsight, grotesque in light of what was to follow, those final days of contentment were now fixed in her memory, preserved, though extinct, like an ancient bug trapped in amber. Since the stroke, Lisette's left arm hung limp at her side. She used her right hand to raise the arm and position it, forearm up, on the cold metal surface of an industrial workbench. A half-empty fifth of rum sat beside it. The old man watched, nodding and grinning around the bit of his unlit corncob pipe, as Lisette took the single-edged razor blade between her thumb and forefinger and rested one sharp point against her skin. Overhead, a failing fluorescent light blinked on and off, its buzzing an incessant lamentation to protest its own mortality. Her heart beating out of her chest, she paused and glanced around the shop floor of the former factory that now housed her husband Isidore's landscaping company. This was the last place her daughter's fiancé, Michael Parrish, would think to look for her. Hell, until she heard herself giving the taxi driver the address, she hadn't expected to find herself here either. Now she realized the old factory was probably the last place on earth she felt at all safe. Her mother's shop, her shop, had been desecrated, and no number of new fixtures or fresh coats of paint could keep her mind's eye from seeing the racial slurs and symbols of hatred sprayed on its walls. Her once beloved home offered no sanctuary. The enemy now lived there, beneath her roof, acting as her caregiver, feigning devotion while preventing her recovery. She drew a breath, then cut the first slit, long enough and deep enough to leave a scar. To leave a scar was the point. This wound and the six to follow, each in honor of Ursulie Dantor, would form a god, part invocation, part petition for protection. A curse had been placed on Lisette, and tonight, she was appealing to Ursulie Dantor to rid her and her family of the man who'd laid it. The stroke hadn't only affected her arm, it had also gifted her with a tremor, a halting step, and slurred speech. Perhaps Dantor, whose tongue had been cut out by those she had trusted, would feel a stronger affinity to her because of it. Besides, Dantor was a mother, too. A mother who protected her children with the same fierceness Lisette felt burning in her own breast. It had taken a visit from Papa Legba himself to awaken Lisette to the truth about Michael. Lisette wouldn't have accepted the revelation from any other source, even her own best instincts, as Michael's power allowed him to make a person see him in whatever light he wanted. He had deceived her for years, and she hadn't had a single inkling. Lisette should have acted sooner. But he had kept her just weak enough to make sure she was housebound. And neither her husband Isidore nor her son Remy would listen to any words spoken against Michael. They had both fallen under his thrall. Only Lisette's father seemed immune to Michael's influence, and Michael did his best to keep her and her dad separated. Lisette knew the only reason she had managed to slip away tonight was because Michael would have never suspected she'd leave Manon's side at such a time. The pain in the sight of her own blood oozing up from the wound fed her anger. The bastard will pay. and Urzuli Dantor will be the one to collect what is due. Lisette wasn't sure if the thought belonged to her or to the old man. He regarded her with glistening dark eyes, his look telling her it didn't matter. He was with her, and she with him. For now, there was no separation. He reached up and pushed back the straw fedora he wore. Only then did she notice the black and red band encircling its crown. Blood ran in a solid trickle down her forearm. A red pool began to form on the workbench's surface. Her lifeblood's coppery scent now competing with the pungent, almost peppery smell of gasoline and sharp green perfume of cut grass that, regardless of season, permeated the building. Above them all floated the crisp chemical pine of a hanging car freshener one of Isidore's workers had hung on the tinsel Christmas tree Isidore insisted on setting out every year. It stood this year, as every year, beside the entrance of the staff break room, about 5 yards from her current workbench. The tacky antique held no lights, just 20 or so sparse green branches adorned with the perennial dollar store silk ball ornaments, red, green, and a champagne color that might have once been gold. The angel on top regarded the scene enacted before her in frozen horror. Lisette damned the angel for judging. She made the second gash. The old man chewed on his pipe and squinted, as if he were considering a puzzling question. He drew the pipe from his mouth, used his free hand to grasp the mug that contained the other half of the rum, and lifted it to his lips for a quick, though appreciative sip. As the old man returned the mug to the table, Lisette considered the words printed on its side. Hell yeah. She hated Mondays too. And of late every other damn day of the week. From the moment Lisette had spotted her father, Alcide Simeon, teetering along drunk down Charter Street, determined to play Celestin Marin's soul into hell with the unfamiliar silver trumpet in his hand. Her world had grown more tumultuous with each passing day, the unthinkable manifesting itself with a disconcerting, disheartening regularity. Each week brought a new earthquake to shake and fracture her once firm foundation. Her bedrock had crumbled into shifting sand. And now her baby girl was dying. Severe preeclampsia. At this very moment, Lisette's girl was in the emergency room at Touro. The good doctors there were doing their damnedest to save both Manon and her unborn child. Michael's unborn child. CT scans and ultrasounds and cardio somethings or other. Fancy tests could diagnose Manon's condition, but no medical intervention could strike at the root cause. The baby's father. It was up to Lisette to do that. She made the third and fourth cuts in quick succession, a feeling like an icy finger tracing down her spine even as her arm caught fire. Leaving Manon, slipping away from Isidore and Remy, had pretty near ripped her heart out, but until she could protect herself, she could do nothing for her daughter. Still, the sight of Isidore hunched over in the waiting room, his fists clenched, his skin ashen, would haunt her the rest of her life. She couldn't even let herself consider what her baby girl must be going through. Ends and means, devil in deep blue. She had sorted through rights and wrongs once she got the job done. Lisette drew the sharp edge along her forearm once more. The old man rocked back on his stool, nodding in approval at the growing tally. She had cut her arm clean off if that's what it took to keep Manon in this world. She would not let her daughter die. Lisette had died briefly. Michael was the one who'd killed her. A bead of sweat formed on her forehead as the second thought trampled over the first. There had been no pearly gates opening wide, no bright light reaching out to embrace her. Instead, she had found herself in a strange world where fire burned cold and dark. Now, whenever she closed her eyes, she saw the exquisite, fearsome face of the fair witch who'd hovered above her, leading a versicle and response recantation of the spell for which Lisette's mother had given her life. A spell to hold the Book of the Unwinding, locked between realities. The witches had returned Lisette to life as a means to counter her mother's magic, rendering her mother's self-sacrifice meaningless. To them, Lisette was a pawn, a key to turn in a lock. Their counterspell required only that they resuscitate her. They'd shown indifference to, or perhaps had even taken delight in, sending her back, damaged. The rising dark tide of greed and violence, lawlessness and disdain for common decency reported in the daily paper and on the evening news bore witness to the fact that the wicked had been successful in their efforts to return the foul book to this world. Where it all would end? She couldn't hazard a guess, but tonight was about shoring up the levees that protected her and her own. Another slash. She fumbled with the razor, the blade slick with her own blood. She registered a metallic glint as it dropped to the floor. The old man pulled a fresh blade from behind the band on his hat, then leaned forward to offer it to her. Lisette reached out to accept the new razor, a sensation like static electricity shooting through her as their fingers brushed. In that instant, any semblance of his being a man fell away. She caught a glimpse behind the facade, and she understood Papa as the entity he was. She sensed the evil, the crawling chaos he alone held back. Annihilation. The word flickered in her mind. Then the curtain fell, and once again before her sat an old man. He lay his pipe on the table, its corncob bowl resting in a finger of her blood. He doffed his hat and laughed, seeming pleased by her flash of insight. He nodded at the blade poised in her fingers, and Lisette fixed her eyes on his, taking strength from the surety she sensed there. She pressed the point of the blade into her skin, the deepest cut of all, and tugged it through her flesh with a savagery fed by her own rage. She laid the blade down beside her wounded arm, then dipped her forefinger into the pool of blood. She traced a heart pierced by a dagger, a simplified rendition of Ursulie Dantor's Vevey, then grasped the rum bottle and emptied its remaining contents over her wounds to feed the god. She gasped, wincing at the fresh fire. The clear rum washed across the workbench's top, diluting her spilled blood as it dripped from the table to the floor, transforming the trickle into a stream. Lisette reached over to the stool she had stationed beside her, catching hold of one of the clean microfiber towels she'd retrieved from Isidore's stash in the cleaning supply closet. That went on top of her forearm, the first step in a makeshift bandage. She layered three more towels over it, then snatched up the roll of silver duct tape from which she had already unrolled a 6-inch lead. She attached the tip of the tape to the exposed skin of her wrist, unwinding the spool as she wrapped the tape around the towels.
"What have you done to yourself?"
Michael asked, appearing, it seemed, from nowhere. He crossed to her and took hold of her left hand.
My God.
She had to give the devil his due. He sounded sincere. like he really gave a damn. Lisette glanced around his shoulder at the old man. Papa held a finger to his lips. Only then did she realize Michael was unaware of the old man's presence. "You followed me," Lisette said, watching Michael's eyes dart around the gore. "No," he said, focusing first on her face, then on her taped arm. His complexion went gray. He was in true shock.
"Yes," he said,
his forehead wrinkling, lips parting.
"But only after we realized you'd gone missing."
His features smoothed as he regained his equilibrium.
"Isidore sent me to find you, since certain staff at the hospital don't quite consider fiancé to be family."
Lisette suspected the boy was lying on both counts, but it didn't matter. She was happy to have him away from Enol. Michael took the spool of tape from her and began wrapping it around her arm, tighter and tighter. Finally, he bent over and bit into the tape, breaking the strand.
"Tourniquet," he said,
rushing around the shop floor till he found a mower belt. He retrieved the blade she had dropped from the floor and cut through the loop, then slipped the belt high around her arm, tugging the ends tight and tying it. He repeated the movement twice, leaving the remaining belt to dangle. The old man rose from his perch and circled around the table to stand at the unaware Michael's side. He nodded a signal the time had come to speak.
"What type of spell did you use?" she said.
She spoke the words slowly and in a loud voice, the way her speech therapist had taught her. Still, the words slurred into one another. Michael's head jerked back, and he examined her with a counterfeit concern.
"Spell?"
Butter wouldn't melt in this bastard's mouth. Lisette could see an aura, like heat rising off blacktop, develop around him. Michael was trying to nudge her perception of him away from suspicion and toward gratitude.
Gratitude.
Lisette nearly snorted.
"What type of spell did you use to find me?"
He stood before her, dumbfounded. This surprise, she intuited, was real. He took a step back, the better to study her. Or maybe to strike.
"My eyes are open," she said. "I see you as you are, witch. And your attacks on my family end right here."
Her words might not have been clear, but by God, she knew he understood her intent. Michael froze for a moment, then howled with laughter.
"Well, get a load of you, Mother Perot."
An inquisitive look rose to his face.
"It's okay for me to call you mother, right? I mean, your daughter and I would already be married if she didn't keep putting me off because you're in such poor shape."
Lisette suddenly realized the delay of the nuptials had nothing to do with her health. Deep down, Manon sensed something was off. A tiny part of her daughter was fighting back against this witch's mind control. Lisette felt sure of it. Manon might have gotten free of him if he had been less determined, but Michael had kept the crosshairs of his power fixed on her. Tiny wrinkles formed at the corners of Michael's eyes as his face lit up with glee.
"Of course, we both know you're never going to recover."
"Not completely."
"But you aren't going to die. Again. At least not until I'm tired of playing with you."
Michael fell silent, then began cracking up again. His amusement infuriated her.
"I'm sorry," he said, though there was no regret in his voice. "But spell?
He paused, looking at her as if she were a total fool.
You stupid bitch. I used my phone to locate yours. I turned on your share location setting when I helped you set it up.
The aura that had formed around him had grown denser, darker, raw.
Isn't technology great?
Lisette recognized the strange fire enveloping him. It was the same cold energy that had lit the twilight realm where the witches had caught her soul and sent it back to her hobbled body. Lisette felt her resolve crumble, fear gripping her heart.
Now I tell you what, he said, speaking in a sugary, patient tone like he was addressing a child. The two of us are going to put this unpleasantness behind us.
He held out his hand.
Come on, take it.
He shook his hand at her.
Come on,
he repeated, this time with greater firmness.
I don't know how you saw through my magic, but I can make you forget. Put us back on a good footing.
Never.
Lisette shook her head.
Never.
The old man circled around her, but she ignored the movement, not wanting to alert Michael to his presence.
Come on. We don't want to miss the show now, do we?
Her tongue felt as if it were carved of wood. She shook her head again, this time not in protest, but to signal a lack of comprehension. He smirked at her. The arrogant son of a bitch actually smirked.
The big miscarriage. It's all been leading to this. Gonna be heartrending.
But, Lisette said in utter amazement, it's your child.
He shrugged.
The little clot has served its purpose. If it were up to me, I would have flushed it down the pipes weeks ago. But I had to wait for the go-ahead from the higher-ups.
He smirked.
Or lower downs. It's all a matter of perspective.
He reached out to her once more.
Last chance. Take my hand, and I'll let Manon survive this horrible, horrible ordeal. Try my patience further, and I'll put an end to her, too. I don't want to, but you're making me.
He looked at her with mock sympathy.
After all, it would be a terrible waste of a fine piece of ass.
He lunged forward and caught hold of her injured arm with both hands, squeezing until the pain drove her to her knees.
There, mother.
He nodded down at her.
It's gonna be all right now.
The black fire surrounding him concentrated on his arms, then crept down, coalescing around his hands. Lisette had never, in this world, felt such cold, agonizing, sharpening rather than calming, the searing of her cuts. She sensed the old man coming closer. In her peripheral vision, she saw him place his hands on either side of her head. Close, but not touching. The cold darkness that had begun to creep up her arm stopped its ascent. Michael regarded her with confusion, then startled, jerking his head up. His expression turned to rage as he released her. Gunfire. One instant Lisette was gazing up at the fury twisting Michael's face. The next he was falling back, the splattered remains of the right side of his head trimming the tinsel Christmas tree. Lisette followed the angel's eyes and looked back over her shoulder. The old man was gone, replaced by another. Her father's silver hair lit up like a halo beneath the dying fluorescent bulb's final flash. 2. Natalie Woodrow hated the sound of jingle bells. She gripped the wheel of her SUV tighter and smiled, casting a quick glance back at the pair of middle-aged women she'd picked up outside the light show in City Park. The women had taken to the "Don We Now" bit with gusto. They wore sparkly snowflake sweaters, one in blue, one in white, and matching red and green felt elf hats, ornamented with jingle bells around the bands. As a finishing touch, each hat was tipped with another larger bell in place of a tassel or pom-pom. They were visitors from Little Rock, one divorced, one widowed. First time for both in New Orleans, or Nolens, as they insisted the city was known to the natives. They were having such fun saying it to each other. Natalie didn't have the heart to set them straight. They were nice enough ladies, really. Good people, both of them. Natalie could tell. And she sure bore them no ill will. All the same, she really hated the sound of jingle bells. Still, the bells weren't the whole of it. She hated the holidays, everything about them. In fact, she hated the whole dang month of December. But Natalie would also hate to bring these nice women down, so she ignored their rhythmic tinkling and sang along with her passengers to the carol playing on the radio. Natalie felt a hand on her upper arm and glanced up into her rearview mirror. One elf was focused on her phone's screen, but the other was leaning forward, craning her head around the side of Natalie's headrest. "Doesn't this music just put you in the holiday spirit?" Spirits. Natalie repressed a shudder. Spirits were the very reason she hated the holidays. Every year, Natalie pasted a jolly smile on her face and responded in kind whenever someone wished her a Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays. The twinkling lights and tinkling bells seemed to summon the most unsavory of ghosts. She'd grown up witnessing apparitions, but she'd learned right quick most people didn't see everyone she did, and those who didn't did not like to be alerted to what they were missing. She could still feel the sharp sting of her mama's slap almost 30 years on. "Why, how could it not?" Natalie responded, doing her best to match the woman's sugar plum enthusiasm. Not quite a lie, but still a good distance from the truth. Her ride-along elf, pleased by the dissimulation, gave her arm a gentle squeeze, then leaned back. Over the years, Natalie had gotten used to seeing spirits, the fresher ones often stumbling around, disoriented, sometimes hostile due to their confusion. She could spot one as easily on Independence Day as on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. But the ghosts of December, they were something different. The spirits she spotted in December were the ugly ones, menacing, raging, desperate. And the closer it got to the winter solstice, the more violent they became. Maybe it was the sharpened emotions, heightened expectations, and inevitable disappointments of the season that fed their anger in much the same way as the holidays affected many of the living. These were the spirits who held on to this world, the ones who sensed they were better off here than with whatever might be waiting for them on the other side. From the warped thoughts and fractured, furious energy Natalie picked up from them, she thought the ghosts of December might be right. It struck her that she hadn't spotted a single demented specter this season. Maybe she hadn't noticed them because she was in a better frame of mind. She was happier this winter than she had ever been. She had Alice now, or at least had the chance of having Alice, and starting New Year's Eve, she'd be working for Evangeline Casey at her club. Not just working the door like she'd been doing on and off since Thanksgiving, but as the club's assistant manager. Both gifts had come unexpectedly on the last day of November, starting with Alice's apologetic, almost embarrassed request for help transporting a table and chairs from a consignment store in the Faubourg Lafayette to her new apartment in the quarter. If Natalie wasn't too busy. If she didn't mind. Natalie would have moved a mountain for Alice. Natalie's assistance had earned her a mushroom po'boy at the diner on Dauphine, from which Natalie had claimed as a souvenir a coaster in the shape of a defiant boy with akimbo arms, his hands pushed deep into the pockets of his suit coat. Perhaps it had granted her luck, because she had had a cup of coffee with Alice at the same place 2 days later, and nearly every day after that, too. Miss Casey had rung her up the same night. Another happy chat had come of that. This time over vodka and tonic. The vodka for Ms. Casey and the tonic for Natalie. She was driving, after all. Things were good. Or at least they were getting good. Only she had a relentless gnawing cold in her gut, warning her the spirit's absence had nothing to do with her. This year the spirits were lying low, or maybe even moving on, to avoid something way scarier than them. Natalie turned off Canal Street and made two quick rights to arrive at the hotel's entrance. "Here you are," she said, with no small sense of relief to be ridding herself of the jingle jangling. "You should pop in for a moment," Elf One said, "and have a look at how they decorated the lobby. They did a marvelous job." "It's true. It is enchanting," her friend said, drawing out the last word for emphasis. Even though Natalie had lived pretty near her entire life a stone's throw in one direction or another from this hotel, she had never actually visited its annual holiday display. "Yeah, no," she said, letting her bright tone imply she had. "They're famous for that." A gentleman in a black top hat approached the SUV and opened its rear door. The women piled out in a tinkling chorus of thank yous, a handful aimed at Natalie, the rest at the hotel's doorman. And happy holidays intended, Natalie felt sure, for her benefit. She waited, watching the women until they'd passed through the hotel's polished brass doors. A sudden, odd concern for their safety rising in her like sap. The sound of gunfire made her jolt, and she slipped down low in her seat, scanning her surroundings for its source. No one else reacted. The doorman stood before the hotel, grinning and greeting passers-by, then rushed to open the door for a guest carrying a multitude of shopping bags. A growing sense of dread bubbled up in her. She took a few deep breaths to slow her heartbeat, ready to call it a night and head home despite the one silver lining in the dark cloud of December. The bounty of fares. She reached over to sign out of the driving app, even as her phone began to ring. A local number. She didn't recognize it. She didn't need to. She sensed who was on the other end. Her finger hovered over the red button, inviting her to decline the call, but Natalie resisted the impulse and tapped the green button instead. "Mrs. Perot?" There was a moment of silence. Then Lisette Perot's panicked voice exploded through the speaker. "I'm sorry," she said, almost shouting. There was a pause, and just as Natalie was about to respond, Lisette continued. "I'm sorry. I know I shouldn't involve you. I do. But I don't know who else to call." "I'm sorry, ma'am. Involve me in what? Are you okay?" "No," came the sharp, angry response. "I am not okay." Natalie could hear Lisette's labored breathing. "Where are you?" Natalie asked, certain she'd regret getting caught up in whatever was going on, but even more sure she'd never forgive herself if she didn't try to help. "Are you at your shop?" Natalie sure hoped not. Ever since she was young, she had done her best to avoid Vevey. The faces that peered out of its paned windows onto Charter Street still sent chills down her spine. "No,
We're at my husband's business, Lisette said, without elucidating on the cryptic we.
Over in Elmwood.
Her tone, though softening, still rang with agitation.
I can find it, Natalie said. Is someone hurt? Do you want me to call an ambulance?
The distant rumble of Lisette's dark laughter startled her.
No, ma chère. It is way too late for that.
Too late. A vision flashed through her mind. An enigmatic older man in a straw fedora. Lisette's father, the quarter's famous trumpet player. She recognized him from the memorial for Alice's Uncle Vincent, which she had attended before she even met Alice. She saw the steely glint of hatred in his eyes, the pistol in his hand. Natalie startled at the peal of gunshot, even though she now recognized it as an echo of an earlier and distant event.
Can I trust you?
Lisette's words broke through Natalie's muddled vision. She repeated herself when Natalie failed to respond, fear and fury twining together in her voice.
I'll come, Natalie said. I'll see what I can do.
She was getting a bit too good at answering direct questions with near truths.
I'll be there as soon as I can.
Another silence, and the call ended. Natalie didn't need to pull up the address of Perot Landscaping, not now that she had picked up on Lisette's anguish. A direct channel, as unyielding and as dangerous as a train track's electrified conductor rail, would deliver her right to Lisette's side. Natalie signaled and checked for oncoming cars before pulling out into traffic. Then, let the dark gravity of Lisette's emotions take over as navigator. Natalie pulled into the parking lot of one of the smaller industrial buildings on Sam's Avenue, her headlights revealing a tan box dominated on one side by a tall gray roller door illuminated by a security light, and on the other by a forest green canopy sheltering the main entrance. Two green and white heavy-duty pickups had been stationed within view of the blinking red light of a security camera. Another camera pointed down at the main door. Whatever Lisette had gotten herself into here tonight, there could be evidence of it on those cameras if the footage wasn't deleted. And maybe even if it was, an inquiring mind might notice the gap carved into the recording. Natalie killed her engine and dug beneath her seat, fishing out an old baseball cap she kept on hand for when it rained. She put the cap on and pulled the bill down to shield her face from the camera. She slipped out of the vehicle and eased the door almost closed, then leaned against it so the latch caught with a quiet click. Only then did it strike her that she was trying to sneak into a place to which she had been summoned. She pulled the cap's bill a bit farther down to cover more of her face. Then she noticed a third security camera pointing straight at her vehicle, privileged with a full frontal view of her license plate. Well, double damn, she muttered under her breath and glared directly at the camera. A shower of white sparks rained down in unison from each of the three devices. So we're gonna start up with that again? She said, angry at herself, at Lisette Perot, and at her own once dormant, now capricious power, jarred loose by her first encounter with Lisette and her mother. Yet another spirit. She slipped under the green canopy and tugged on the door handle. The door rattled but remained closed. She noticed a button to the side of the door and pushed it. A moment later, she heard a quick buzz, followed by a click. A disheartening sense of deja vu told her she might not ought to open the door. But she was here, and she was needed. She grasped the handle again and, overestimating the strength it would take to open the door, swung it wide. Natalie had seen things before, real bad things,
especially in the last 5 months or so. The tableau that greeted her, she decided in a flash, landed squarely at number two. Right after watching the reanimated corpse of her former boss crab walk across the floor on limbs, first severed and then reattached the wrong way, left to right and forward to back. No, Natalie told herself, trying to siphon a grain of optimism from the situation. Compared to that, the sight of Lisette Perrot on her knees, covered in blood spatter, and struggling with one arm to drag a corpse onto an uncooperative blue plastic tarp, was a cakewalk. Lisette broke off from her efforts and looked up at Natalie with an ashen face and haunted eyes. "He wasn't a good man," she said, the pronouncement ringing with the finality of a full explanation, then renewed her labors. "Hell, maybe it was explanation enough." "No, ma'am," Natalie said, choking back the bile rising in her throat. "I'm guessing he wasn't, or we wouldn't be here." Natalie drew closer to the body. Too close. She could see a good portion of the man's head had been blown off, and the stench of murder gripped her stomach and gave it a good shake. Natalie's attention glided up from the floor to a blood-coated workbench, then to a fake Christmas tree topped by an angel whose face had been painted with an eternally alarmed expression that probably mirrored her own. "Help me," Lisette said, a desperate keening in her voice as she fought to gain traction in an oval of congealing blood. Natalie noticed Lisette's left arm, wrapped in silver duct tape and tied off with a length of rubber. Blood was seeping out of each end of the metallic bandage and in a spiral along its winding seam. Natalie rushed forward, her new sneaker pressing a flawless imprint of its tread into the gore, triggering memories of every single police procedural she had ever read or watched. "You're hurt," she said, taking a step back. Only then did she realize she had managed to leave a textbook-perfect blood transfer print on what had, a second before, been a patch of clean floor. Hell, if she was implicated, the quality of the evidence she was creating against herself would probably be perfect enough to convince any sane juror she'd been framed. She shook the thought off and focused on the only person in the room who seemed more terrified than she was. Natalie approached Lisette the way she would a frightened child. "He hurt you?" she said. She squatted beside her and slipped an arm around her waist, then rose and stepped back, bringing Lisette with her. The body slipped to the floor. "This was self-defense," she said, easing Lisette onto a stool beside the bloodied workbench. The sound of a leather sole slapping the concrete spun Natalie around.
"Yes, young lady,"
came a man's weary voice from a patch of shadow at the far end of the floor.
"It was. Everything you say is true, although not in the way you think."
The voice belonged to Lisette's father, Alcide Simeon. His name came to her. Mr. Simeon stepped forward into the light, though to Natalie it seemed a finger of the shadow followed him, like gum stuck to the heel of his shoe. He still held the pistol that Natalie assumed had done the damage. Natalie offered one opportunity to ambush her per customer. If Mr. Simeon was here, like in her vision, then the elderly man in the fedora was more than likely lurking somewhere too. She glanced around the space, scanning for the missing man. "Where's your friend?" she addressed Mr. Simeon. "Is he still here?" The silver-haired man's head tilted back, a line creasing his forehead as he, too, began to survey the push and riding lawnmowers stowed along the room's perimeter.
"Friend? What friend?"
"The old guy, no offense," she added with the same breath. in the head. A look passed between father and daughter.
Only been two men here tonight.
Him? He nodded down at the body.
And me.
The way he'd lingered on the word men told her she wasn't the only one good at deflecting direct questions. Natalie was, she reckoned, witnessing karma in action.
We owe her more than equivocation.
Lisette addressed the words to her father, then turned her face to Natalie.
What you perceived as a man, she said, is anything but. I won't skimp on clarification once we've dealt with this situation, but now I've got more pressing issues.
You talk some sense to my girl.
She's thinking she can clean all this, he said,
brandishing the pistol in a wide sweep encompassing half the room.
Up. Make it like nothing happened. But sooner or later, and it's gonna be sooner, truth'll out.
You should probably put that down, sir, Natalie said, with a nod toward the gun. He looked down at it with surprise, as if he had forgotten he held it in his grip. He bent down with some effort, bracing himself by placing his free hand on his left knee, and laid the gun on a clean stretch of the concrete floor. Hand on knee, he pushed himself up.
If it isn't the police who come for me,
he planted his gaze on Natalie.
It's gonna be one of you.
He studied her face, and then shook his head.
Don't be coy with me, young lady. You know what I mean.
Well, no, sir, I...
Witches!
He shouted the word at her. Then his lips curled up like he had tasted something bitter.
One of you witches.
Oh, okay, she said, rattled less by the unexpected novelty of being called a witch than by the sense of rightness with which the label struck her. You have nothing to worry about for me, she said, trying to reassure herself as much as to convince Mr. Simeon. Mrs. Perot trusted me enough to call me. Her words trailed off, as the single part of her mind that wasn't reeling picked that precise moment to raise a pertinent question. She turned her focus to Lisette. Why did you call me? Lisette regarded her with a cautious look.
Because you saw much worse than this the night you helped my mama and me. You've kept quiet about that. I'm hoping you'll do the same now.
Her memories from the night Natalie had agreed to serve as Mrs. Simeon's schwal remained a bit dim, at least those made while Mrs. Simeon had controlled Natalie's body. Still, enough of what she had witnessed the night of the witch's ball burst into her consciousness to kick even the sight of Frank's tortured corpse to second place on her list of horrors. The scene before her now ranked a distant third.
I did this.
Mr. Simeon's voice pulled Natalie back.
I will take responsibility for it. I need you,
he began, crossing the room till he stood beside his daughter.
To see to my girl.
Natalie caught sight of a swirling movement on the far side of the shop floor. She craned her neck and focused on the area. The finger of shadow that had attached to Mr. Simeon resolved itself as an arm. Like one bubble breaking free of another, an outline of a man pulled itself up and out of the surrounding darkness, falling forward onto its hands and feet. The smell of sulfur rose up all around them. This, Natalie realized, was the bigger and badder thing her regular spirits were avoiding. A demon. And it didn't count as her first. Her mind flashed to the night of the conjuring at Grunch Road, when she had narrowly succeeded in preventing a shadow demon from dragging Alice down into the crumbling earth. She stumbled backward, pointing at the entity, first mouthing and then yelling, "There! There!" once her wind caught up with her panic. A second entity broke free from the shadow, this one screeching and squealing as a third demon forced its way around it. They lumbered forward, their humanoid shapes fading into an amorphous mist that joined together as one and crept across the floor covering the body. Lisette jumped up, knocking over the stool she'd been sitting on. Mr. Simeon caught hold of his daughter.
"You're doing this,"
he called to Natalie, as he dragged Lisette back. His accusation held more hope than rancor.
"Better the devil, you know,"
Natalie thought, as the unified shadow creature grew, lengthening, spuming till it swallowed not only the body, but also the gore-covered workbench. "We should go," she said, already in retreat toward the entrance. She glanced back at the front entrance to see another dark mist roiling there behind them. Natalie spun toward the rear door, which, for the moment, stood clear. "Move!" she yelled as she bounded over to Lisette and her father, bowling into them and pushing them in the direction of the exit, even as she reached out to right them. She sent a burst of energy ahead, a solid punch that blew the rear exit door off its hinges, leaving their path wide open. "Now that," she spoke directly into Mr. Simeon's ear, "I did do." She steered them toward the opening. A force reached out and slammed them to the floor, knocking the wind out of her. She felt a hand grab her ankle, its grip burning cold like dry ice. She pushed up onto her hands and knees and tried to pull away, but the hand yanked her back, pulling her a good 20 feet from the door. She looked up to discover the creeping shadow had swallowed the workbench and was working its way up the artificial tree. As she watched, helpless, it climbed to the highest bough and cascaded over the plastic angel. It then slid down the other side of the tree and along the floor until it rested within an arm's length of Lisette and her dad. Then Natalie saw the elderly man from her vision circle the two, tracing a barrier around them with his cane. He turned to the shadow, holding his cane high, and advanced on it. The shadow pulled back in a sudden great wave, taking with it all it had touched, the blood-spattered tree and its unfortunate angel, the gory workbench, the body, the blood that had pooled around it. These things diffused and became part of the mist that continued to recede until it had begun to pass through the building's solid walls. Natalie felt the grip around her ankle loosen, and she jumped up and bolted forward. Her uneven stride caused her to glance down as she ran, only to realize her shoe, the one she had trailed through the blood, was missing. In the moment before the shadow completely disappeared through the wall, something shot out from within it and fell with a hollow sound to the floor. The object bounced up and came down again, about a yard from Natalie's unshod foot. The plastic angel gazed up at her in wonder. 3. Alice Marin stood on the fourth floor balcony, looking down at the view. From one angle, a view of St. Louis Cathedral's steeples rising above the neighboring building's duo HVAC units, and from the other, the twin spans of the Crescent City Connection cantilever bridge, straddling the Mississippi. She grasped the window's casing and closed her eyes, leaning forward and breathing in the river's muddy scent on the breeze, trying to convince herself she was finally home. She opened her eyes and turned away from the window. One plain truth could not be ignored. If she were home, she wouldn't have agreed to pay an astronomically high rent so she could lease a partially furnished apartment on a month-to-month basis.
She needed to keep her options open, a sense of possibility alive, even if that meant having one foot out the door. She couldn't bear to be confined again. Not in an asylum, not on the Dreaming Road, not even in her once-upon-a-time hometown. The apartment was dark except for the French Quarter's ambient all-night glow, and a short strand of battery-powered lights that coiled in a sloppy spiral around a miniature rosemary Christmas tree, a sweet gift from the ever-prudent Natalie. Natalie, tense and voluble, had been tentative about offering her the gift, shifting it from hand to hand. Before Alice could even speak, she had provided her with 100 excuses not to accept it, even grumbling that she hated the holidays herself, so she didn't know what had possessed her to buy it. Still, Natalie had glowed with pleasure when Alice took the plant from her, then leaned in and kissed her. After their meal that afternoon, Natalie walked her home from their cafe. Yes, in spite of herself, Alice had begun to think of the coffee shop on the edge of the Marigny as theirs. When they reached Alice's door, Natalie fished a pack of miniature lights out of her pocket. "Maybe these are stupid," she said, pressing the lights into Alice's free hand. "I couldn't decide." She hesitated, then dared another quick peck on Alice's lips before startling at the sound of the cathedral's bells and darting away, calling back over her shoulder that she was late to a meeting with her boss, with Evangeline. Natalie had left Alice, plant and possibly stupid lights in hand, on her doorstep laughing. Alice realized that since she'd returned from the Dreaming Road, she'd only laughed, at least with sincerity, twice. Both times were because of Natalie. She approached the plant and gently rubbed a few of its leaves between her thumb and forefinger. She lifted her hand to her nose to savor the fragrance. Rosemary. Alice suspected Natalie had perceived its magical properties as a ward against evil spirits and nightmares, just as Natalie had intuited how to draw closer to her without making her feel cornered. Alice would set the pace, if there was a pace to be set. This was Natalie's real gift to her. The lights on the plant flickered, and they grew heavier, denser, the sensation erasing the smile she had felt lingering on her lips. Though she had not seen him since before her years-long imprisonment on the Dreaming Road, Alice needed no visual confirmation of his presence. She sensed him staring up at her window, the intensity of his gaze enough to affect her apartment's ambience. Rosemary, effective against evil spirits and nightmares, but not against a callous, prideful ass like Nicholas Marin. Alice crossed the room and snatched up a key ring with a hand trembling not from fear, but from fury. She leaned out the window and flung the keys, aiming for Nicholas's face, her smug target lit by the glow of a lamppost lantern. Her aim was true, but he stepped back, leaving them to land at his feet. Offering him the keys, even as a missile, was nothing more than a symbolic gesture. If he wanted to enter, he needed neither her permission nor her keys. Nicholas was renowned for coaxing locks open. He bent down and picked them up, then looked back up at her, shaking his head. The ever-patient father, disappointed by a little girl's tantrum. Only, he wasn't her father. He was her half-brother. Still, that knowledge couldn't undo the years of history between them. Regardless of their true relationship, a part of her would always see him as the father who'd abandoned her. And Nicholas, she understood, would always use the ambiguity of their relationship to keep her off kilter. Alice flipped on a lamp, and Daniel's crooked, self-conscious smile greeted her. No photos of Daniel existed. Servitor spirits couldn't be photographed. His image was always blurred, as if the camera's shutter couldn't blink fast enough. She'd been working on this painting of him for weeks,
determined to catch his essence before his image slipped from her memory. Alice was wearing the shorty pajamas that Lucy, herself appointed personal shopper, had purchased on